Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Carl Devine, who's an associate professor in the Department of Musicology at the University of Oslo, about Decomposed, the Political Ecology of Music. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave. It's nice to be here.
This is both an incredibly interesting book, but given what we know about how long it takes to produce academic books, the timing of it is spectacularly perfect. As we're confronted daily with evidence of the global climate catastrophe, particularly I'm thinking about images that we're getting from Australia, but also changing weather patterns in places like Canada. A book that tries to get to grips with the ecological cost of what seems to be something that has nothing to do with the environment is incredibly important right now. And I guess the place to start with the book is that question, actually, that what got you interested in writing about music from an ecological perspective? Because they don't quite seem to be two topics that immediately connect to each other.
Yeah, well, I guess I started working on the book in 2012. And actually, I can just start by giving you a personal thanks, Dave, because I was doing the article that became the book while we shared an office at Citi in London. We had early conversations about all of this, so it's a fun full circle thing to be here on the podcast talking about it.
Yeah, and it's great to see the book published as well.
Yeah. But back in 2012, I started working on this project, and it was sort of because I kept encountering these two ideas that made me uncomfortable, and they seemed to reinforce one another as well. First is this old idea that music is somehow the most immaterial of the arts. And second, that the history of recorded music could be told as a history of dematerialization, right? This evolution from these physical discs to invisible digits. But even back in 2012, right, there's a lot of good work in media studies looking at, the sort of weight of the internet and the weight of our consumption of electronics and things. So I knew back then that digital files are material things and that online consumption was not weightless, right? And because I work in music and because, not only was there this prevalent sense that the internet was somehow weightless in lots of sort of everyday thinking, but also that music is the most immaterial of the arts, and they kind of compounded one another, these two ideas. So I basically started out, I just wanted to know about the resources and the energy, both natural and human, that were required to make downloading and streaming possible. And from there, I spun out and started looking at the other main formats in the history of recorded music. And I started to look at the history of recorded music in terms of three staple commodities and their supporting casts. So from 1900 to 1950, most records were made of something called shellac. And from 1950 to 2000, all the major recording formats, LPs, 45s, cassettes, and CDs. Those are all made of plastic. And since about the year 2000, increasingly people downloaded and streamed music. So that's sort of where the book comes from and gives you a sketch of the chapters.
I mean, it's a remarkable story of incredible, both, you know, social and cultural change, but actually with the continuity of we need to take seriously how these material, both objects and material practices are impacting. And crucially, actually, you know, you mentioned almost just in passing there the kind of the human resources involved, which is something I think the book does really well, actually, is not just to say, you know, making shellac or creating plastic or whatever has an environmental cost, but, you know, these are global supply chains. We need to think about, you know, how things are produced, where particular factories are, what the labor force is, the increasingly kind of interlinked inequalities of global production.
Yeah.
Again, you know, as you say, you know, we've noticed the shift to whatever, Spotify or the MP3, but actually that story is still there. I guess the question that comes from that is, how can we illustrate this? And you did a perfect job of the three different materials. So maybe actually we could start by telling the story of shellac. You know, we think of vinyl as the kind of the classic format for particularly albums. And the story of shellac is something that, again, draws us back to the human and environmental costs of music.
Yeah. So the story of shellac begins in India. Shellac is a resin that is secreted by a beetle. It's called the lac beetle. And there'd been an international shellac trade for, you know, hundreds of years. But it really wasn't until the early 1900s when the record industry started requiring shellac in its discs. And they tried different materials before. There were wax cylinders. Discs were made from rubber, and basically anything you can imagine. But they started using shellac in huge numbers in the early 1900s. And it was around that point that actually the record industry drove the global sort of explosion of the shellac industry. So the record industry here wasn't just a kind of passive observer of, you know, these bigger global supply chains and global stories. This was an active contributor to that, actually drove developments in that industry. And so to harvest this shellac in various parts of India, there were you know, a lot of different workers that would go out into these, you know, the fields with the trees where the shellac beetles would secrete their resin. They would basically just get the resin off the branches however they could, gather those up, bring them to a sort of processing plant or factory where the material was sort of washed and dried and melted and processed in various ways, put into sacks and shipped out to various record industry folks around the world from places like Calcutta. And so that's, you know, it's kind of interesting and, you know, quirky or whatever, maybe, to think that records are, you know, for a long time were made of bugs. And it is kind of quirky and interesting. But the conditions for the people that worked in that industry were really bad. There's one of the main sources I used in the book was a Government of India labor report, published in 1946, I believe, and basically described aspects of the shellac industry as sweatshop industries. People were paid extremely low wages. They were worked extremely hard. They didn't have security of their jobs because shellac was a seasonal commodity, which meant that they got into tremendous amounts of debt to their employers in the off seasons when they needed money to support themselves and their families. And on in these ways. So it wasn't a very nice industry on that end of it, for sure.
That's one element, I guess, you know, and there are many elements of 20th century and then 21st century life that have these, you know, kind of hidden, very grim production practices. But I was also struck by, you know, if the material is a story of exploitation and the global South, actually making like records as records has an important gender politics to it, and a particular set of really obviously kind of, I suppose, gendered incentives around who worked in factories and how much, or actually more importantly, how little they got paid.
Right. You mean the record pressing plants themselves?
Yeah, I was really struck when you were talking about RCA being, you know, basically sort of a female production force in their plants, because women's labor was cheaper, you know, as a really kind of bit of ruthless kind of you know, business and capitalist decision making.
Yeah, so there's a great book by Jefferson Cowie called Capital Moves, which is about RCA's sort of quest for cheap labor. And around the late 1940s, RCA's recording facilities moved a significant portion of what they were doing to Indiana. And the reason for that was that even though shellac is the sort of symbolically important ingredient in records from that time, shellac was actually a minor component in the discs, around 15%. Most of those discs was just crushed rock. And the best and most of that crushed rock came from Indiana. So the record company moved its production facilities to Indiana, I guess, to save on long haul shipping. But there, you know, this was also a region that had experienced a lot of problems since the Depression, and some of their local industries had collapsed, and the people that worked in those industries didn't have much experience with organized labor unions. And so this was a kind of perfect storm where RCA could move in there. They could have abundant, very cheap labor. They could basically prevent them from organizing. And they did use a lot of male labor for heavy lifting and things like this, but there were also a lot of women in the area that did work in the plant as well. Many of them worked in quality control, sort of listening to records that were pressed and making sure that they sounded okay. But there were plenty of them that worked on the pressing floor as well. And you know, the typical story there of sort of inequality and exploitation. They're paid less than men. They have discourses surrounding them about, you know, they're supposedly deft and nimble fingers, which is a really prevalent discourse in the electronics industry as well around women's labor. You know, expected to leave their jobs once they married, and things like this. And this goes through the shellac era and into the plastic era as well. Some of the very same conditions defined women's labor in LP pressing plants as well. And I think, I mean, one of the things about this is that often the story of the record industry is a kind of boys and toys, men and machines kind of history that gets told. But this, you know, looking at these material, ecological, human labor costs that extend beyond, you know, listening to the music pressed into a record, you know, opens up this broader history of labor and exploitation that is really pressed into every record during that period, regardless of what the music on that record was. These are the broad conditions that defined all the music heard and made and listened to for a long, long time.
And how are they made? You know, we've heard a bit about the material, a bit about the workforce, but what's the industrial process of making the old 78?
Yeah. So once that shellac was shipped to a record pressing plant, and once that record pressing plant had its crushed rock and all of that, this stuff is essentially mixed and heated and mixed into a kind of goopy substance. And there were different ways of making things, but essentially they would get little. This goopy substance would be divided into little pucks, and these pucks would go into a machine that lots of people describe as the press itself. They describe it as kind of like a waffle iron, and it just squashes the record, and out comes the record, and it cools, and it's essentially ready to go. And there's a lot of other processes that happen there, chemical plating and everything, to make the actual the pieces on the waffle iron that get pressed together, we'll call them. The book looks less at those, but those were certainly, you know, processes that used a lot of chemicals, which were probably dumped indiscriminately and were toxic and could harm employees if they weren't treated correctly.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I mean, that's probably the classic bit of sort of popular imagination of making a record at a time when, you know, there are various sort of arguments about how music itself was quote unquote industrially produced or not. And that, you know, various American recording studio systems goes hand in hand with the vision of, yeah, pucks being pressed on an industrial scale. Now, the book sort of I've mentioned has this, you know, continuity and change element to it. And I guess, you know, plastic and, you know, broader sort of changes in materials has a big effect on the recording industry. Along the categories and along the lines we've already discussed. And it'd be good to hear about, I think that's, you know, the kind of core of chapter two, the story of changes in the political ecology of the recording industry after the 1950s.
Right. Well, yeah, this is a long story. It's hard to say in a few words. I mean, so basically the story that's most often told about why the recording industry shifted from shellac to plastic is a story of increased sound quality, right? These records had, you know, the LPs played for, you know, over 20 minutes rather than just a few minutes of a shellac disc. They had hair width micro grooves, and they had less the sort of noise floor of a shellac record is often compared to the sizzle of bacon. And the LPs didn't have that same noise floor. They had a kind of crackle that people eventually came to cherish. and that sure is part of the story. But a bigger part of the story is the Second World War produced blockages of trade routes that impelled the record industry to consider other materials and more expensive materials with more urgency. So the war is a big part of that story, but it's also, you know, the timeline of that story is a little bit different than I think at least than I understood it before, because, you know, the plastic was used in the recording industry almost as soon as synthetic plastics were synthesized. And this was in 1928, 1930. And as soon as companies were able to do this, one of the often their first calls were to the record industry. And so the record industry was actually using a fair bit of plastic in various contexts from the 1930s and much before the kind of 1948, 1950 mark, when most people think of LPs as being introduced. There's actually a significant market for children's records. They're called kid discs. And that was probably the most significant early use of plastic in the record industry in 1930s and 40s. And that had nothing to do with sound quality. That was because these discs were durable and because kids could sort of abuse them and the records could take a beating. And with all of this, the underlying political ecology of the record industry changes as well. It becomes associated with diversified automotive interests. Eventually, you know, big companies like BP in the UK, for example, which supplied a lot of the vinyl for records in the UK during the 70s boom. The way I summarize it in the book is that the ecological center of gravity would have shifted around this time from forests of the Southeast to oil fields of the Middle East.
And what was the impact on the workers?
Well, the process of making a plastic LP is not essentially different from making a shellac 78. They both involve this process of squishing goop and making it into a disc. And the working conditions were, as I said, remarkably similar. There was use of cheap women's labor, and there were infractions on the health conditions of certain workers, as well as indiscriminately disposing of some of the toxic chemicals used to make PVC in pretty nasty ways. And at this, the one story I focus on in the book there is in the U.S. There's a corporation called Keyser Century, which was a main supplier of LP plastic to the U.S. record industry around the vinyl boom. And Keyser Century had been under investigation by the Environmental Protection Agency as early as 1977, and on and off again until the year 2000, when the EPA came back. This time they brought the FBI and they gave the company a significant fine for dumping hazardous waste onto its property and for releasing chemicals at toxic levels in the plant itself, which also drifted into an elementary school across the road and was risking harming children. So this problem of poisoning groundwater potentially and harming workers and even people in the surrounding area is something that seems as though it was prevalent. I don't think that the Keyser Century example would be unique. In fact, where the book begins is with this contemporary thing that everyone likes to call the vinyl revival.
Mm.
And so for that, I was interested in the conditions of how contemporary records were made. And I went to a pressing plant in the States, and that was, you know, very interesting. Processes haven't changed really since the 50s, although that they are changing a bit now. People are introducing new processes. But it's a really kind of interesting warehouse where there are these big containers that have these lentil-like polymer pellets that get funneled down into the machinery. They get heated. They become these little discs that look like hockey pucks. And then those get squashed and they make records. And the company wouldn't tell me where its plastic for making those records came from. But I did see these big fridge-sized boxes on the pressing floor. And they had these big red letters on them that said vinyl product or vinyl compound, product of Thailand. And so it took me a long time to, didn't take me that long to figure out which company it was, which was Thai Plastic and Chemicals Corporation. It did take me a long time to try and make my way to get a tour of their plant. And I did go to Bangkok where they're headquartered. I didn't get a tour of the plant, but I was, you know, did discuss the business with one of their representatives who, you know, by that time I'd started to find out that, that the plant in Bangkok itself had a reputation for pouring toxic wastewater into the main river that flows through Bangkok, and where they process the raw PVC resin in the south of Thailand had a reputation as you know, a very toxic place with birth defects and things like that in the area. And the Thai Plastic and Chemicals certainly didn't want to talk about that. When I tried to raise these questions, the representative, you know, asked me rhetorically, you know, well, if PVC plastic is used to make medical tools that save people's lives, how can you say that it's toxic?
Wow.
And that was their deflection.
I mean, it's such a radically different history of recorded music, isn't it? You know, instead of going from New York, Detroit, Nashville, LA as the story, actually, you know, we're telling a story of, as you mentioned, India, the Middle East, and now Thailand. And the assumption would always be like, yeah, this is all true, but basically like 15 years ago, that all stops. And now we just have music given to us by ones and zeros. And vinyl, you know, is a tiny proportion of the music buying market. We can skip over somehow the CD revolution because that's basically digital and, you know, everybody's just streaming now. So music has been freed from these exploitative material concerns. But again, you know, towards the end of the book, you're keen to say, well, actually, the digital has material elements as well. And I'm interested to know what they are. And I guess on a really fundamental level, what's the real cost of how we consume music now?
Right. So the way, I'm forgetting who says this, maybe Matthew Kirschenbaum and as well as Jonathan Stern, they have a really nice way of illustrating what it is about the digital or illustrating that the digital is fundamentally material. And the way they say it is, if digital files weren't physical things, your hard drive would never fill up. Right. So yeah. Digital files take up space. The space is microscopic. You can't see it, but it is material. And, you know, storing that data, processing it and transmitting it around the world, downloading it and streaming it all requires energy. And it requires a lot of energy, given the amount of online traffic that exists now. This is, you know, one way in which streaming is potentially not the way forward, because the data that I collected, which surprised me, was, you know, I did some I needed a way to compare the amount of plastic used by the record industry to, you know, the fact that, of course, the record industry does use a tremendous amount less plastic today than at the height of the CD, the cassette, or the vinyl LP, right? Hmm. They use way less plastic. But once you do some conversions of the amount of plastic used to greenhouse gas equivalents, and if you do the same for the forms of electricity that are used to power streaming and downloading today, it looks like the amount of greenhouse gas equivalents released by the record industry actually increase after streaming takes over, at least since 2015. So these are, you know, these are real costs of, you know, streaming that often, you know, happens quite constantly and without a thought for those issues.
Yeah, and all of our metaphors, like, you know, oh, it comes from the cloud.
From the cloud, streaming, even I go at some other metaphors in the book, even the idea of a network suggests or has a tendency to suggest that you know, the data is just sort of out there and purely virtual. But it's, you know, it's the telecoms infrastructure that we rely on for listening to music on the internet, as well as all the other things we do, is mainly hardwired, definitely material, and it uses a lot of energy.
So what, this sounds like a strange question, and maybe there are two bits of it, but on the one hand, there's a kind of, so what should we do? And I think there's an obvious taking seriously the material production of music and trying to make it less environmentally and humanly impactful or damaging. But also I think, and I'm interested to hear your thoughts on that, but also I think there's an interesting research or intellectual question that this poses, because there are strains in various, whether it's, you know, musicology or, you know, you see it with other art form studies that are just like, so what? You know, that doesn't stop Beethoven being Beethoven, or, you know, the various misdemeanors of key 20th century rock or electronic composers or whatever. Well, you know, music is timeless, it's beautiful, the aesthetic triumphs any questions of ideology or materiality. So whilst you might get most people agreeing that we should stop destroying the planet, what does your material analysis mean for, I suppose, scholars that would, you know, be slightly more dismissive of the impact of a material analysis on their scholarship of music?
Yeah, I mean, there have been no shortage of music scholars who who don't think that this matters. I mean, even if they agree it matters, they just don't think that what I've done is, in a sense, music research. There's no shortage of that. So there's a few qualifiers maybe I should offer, which is that I wouldn't deny that music can be, you know, beautiful or special or, you know, full of ways of connecting people, enriching people's lives and all of this. The book doesn't say that music doesn't do those things, right? And I should also say that, you know, I'm fully implicated in all of this, right? I've played in bands that have released CDs and records. I happen to own a few records. I do subscribe to a streaming service, right? I'm completely implicated in this. So I'm not writing or speaking about any of this from up on a high horse. But, you know, I do think that it's important to recognize these things in music, and even in some of the music that we want to value most highly. It's not immune. It's not separate from the conditions that define most of the other areas of commodity culture that we exist in. And the kind of whatever we want to call it, if there's an ideology of music that does suggest it's special and apart from these other realities, I strongly think that needs to be dismantled. And, you know, it may seem unkind or whatever to demote or deflate this cultural form that most of us are used to exalting or exceptionalizing. But you know, actually the way I argue about it in the book is that it's that those of us who are most concerned with the goodness, potential goodness and beauty of music, and the value of music, should actually be the first to welcome a critique of these broader political ecological conditions. It should be the last people to hide from these realities in the interest of sort of, well, coding themselves in familiar aesthetic comforts or ways of thinking about music. So yeah, I do think it's really important to do this kind of deflationary work in relation to music. And, you know, it is also, it's the kind of thing that has happened in other realms, right? We think about coffee or clothing or food in ways that people wouldn't have at one point. And none of those things is working out perfectly. But you know, it seems like for at least some people, there have been some material improvements. And, you know, music isn't as big of a problem in any of this as the automobile industry or food or even coffee, probably. I don't have direct comparison there, but that's not, again, a good argument for ignoring its contribution to the bigger picture.
That project you mentioned about the dismantling, is that what you're going to be doing more of? You know, will it be like a decomposed two come in, which, you know, there might be some fruitful comparisons actually with the coffee industry and trade and things like tea and coffee. Or are you going to be doing something slightly different with your next project?
It's a good question. I mean, in the book, I do end by, because the immediate question, it was almost like, you know, in many of the responses to the book, the impulse is to jump into what next, right? So I'm very grateful that you took the time to want to hear about the other parts of the book before we got there. But it's an inevitable question. And I don't have the answers. I'm not particularly hopeful either. But in terms of the what next, I provide some answers in the book that are more along the lines of what not to do. And just briefly, those are the, you know, I don't think that thinking in romantic terms about previous formats is going to get us anywhere, really, because some people would say, oh, well, we'll just, you know, go back to even plastic recordings, right? Because if the emissions are greater from streaming, we should go back to plastic. But of course, if people bought records at the rate that they stream music, of course, records would be much worse in environmental terms. And even, you know, going back to something like shellac, which is, oh, well, it's a natural resin, it's biodegradable, it's renewable. You know, those things are all true. But I think if you look at the labor conditions that existed before in the global shellac industry, I'm not sure, you know, that I would be very enthusiastic about moving back to shellac as a main staple commodity for music. In terms of, you know, what comes next, again, I don't have good answers. You ask if I'm going to work on a decomposed two. I'm thinking about a project called Recomposed, the Ecological Record. So that sounds a lot like a sequel, doesn't it?
Yes.
So I was at there's a big industry conference called Making Vinyl, which is for the main plastic recording format enthusiasts and business people. And basically what I was there to do was to find out what the level of industry discourse was on trying to make a record out of a non oil-based plastic, right? So a record made out of mushrooms or a record made out of food waste, for example. And I'm interested in that project. I think if there's a next book, it's probably is a book about how to think about what comes next. I don't have the answers there, but I think maybe in the book there are moments where it suggests that individual ethos of consumption might be a way out of this. And I actually don't think that, right? This is why the book isn't meant to make people feel guilty about streaming or anything like that. Because, you know, I really like the perspective of a Canadian researcher called Max Liboiron, who does stuff on plastics research in the ocean. And, you know, she's being asked in a little documentary called Guts, she's being asked, you know, what do we do about the plastics problem in the ocean? And she says, if you want to do anything about this problem, it does absolutely nothing to stop, say, getting plastic bags at a grocery store. She says, at the level of individual or personal ethics, it of course matters a lot how you choose to exist and do those things. At the scale of the problem, it's absolutely ineffective, right? So the interviewer presses her, you know, well, what would you do? And she says, if you want to solve the plastics problem in the ocean, you regulate the oil industry. And so I'm trying to square that with my own thinking on this a little bit more as I move forward from the book. You know, because I don't think that our individual choices at the scale of the problem are going to make a big difference. And I think, you know, Josh Lepowski, who's actually, I believe, a colleague of Max Liboiron, has this great book called Reassembling Rubbish. And, you know, he says having things like, I don't know, if you had a little, he doesn't say this, but I'm drawing on him. You know, if you had a little energy monitor when you were streaming Spotify or whatever that let you know what kind of electricity or where the energy to get your electricity comes from, how much of it we're using, you know, maybe these kinds of things do something. But I think there's evidence to suggest that that kind of sort of self-regulation is a pretty pernicious thing. But he says, you know, he calls for what he describes as genuine extended producer responsibility. But it's not so much about consumer responsibility, although that's a part of the equation. He says what is needed is for people to band together to demand that the producers in the system conduct themselves responsibly and openly.